Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is the Story of London podcast, a series that tries to tell the chronological events of the City of London in the form of a grand narrative. For the last eight parts of this story, I've been trying to explain the incredibly complicated politics of London during the last years of the reign of King Edward III and the opening years of his heir and grandson, the young King Richard II. It's a time of extraordinary politics, where factions rose out of underlying complicated economic drivers, and where there were born upon the streets passionate political debates and political giants who strode the city, dominated the life of the people there, and yet whose stories are mostly forgotten about today. In attempting to do their story justice, I have placed the incredible tale of their ongoing political struggles under a subtitle, The Saga of the Jubilee, referencing a book that in many ways was the glue that tied all these men's stories together. And yet, despite having spent weeks on this subject, the saga is still not yet done. London had become a place where the city was swinging violently from one political faction to another, where today's mayor is tomorrow's jailed criminal, where violence, manifested in the form of armed gangs skulking along its alleyways, or in public executions on high streets, or even in the bloodthirsty mobs of the peasants' revolt. All of these had stained the streets red with blood, and still it continued. Nicholas Brembe was the mayor of London, again. John de Northampton had been carted off to the royal dungeons for life, and the city seemed ready to settle down. But events elsewhere were about to make that impossible. Right, enough introduction. It is my pleasure to welcome you to the next part of this saga and the 137th chapter of the story of London, of Great Tribulations. The thing about big, life-changing events is often they start in small things. Small things or far-away things. It's time to talk about a far-away thing that was to have a huge impact on our story. And as such, it's important right now, in our narrative about the City of London, that we leave it and travel many, many miles to the south, to somewhere called Aljubarrota, located in Portugal. On the 14th of August, 1385, so the year before this episode starts really focusing upon things, there were two armies marching towards each other. On the one side was a force of the men of Portugal, about 7,000 or so of them. But opposite them, coming directly in a beeline towards them, were about 14,000 men under the banners of Castile. The Castilians were led by their king, Juan, and they were travelling south from the Montijo Valley, this being the traditional invasion route towards Portugal. Their aim was to lay siege to the city of Lisbon. But as they travelled, they were intercepted by a Portuguese army, led by their newly elected king, João of Aviz. It was late in the day, however. Both kings decided neither wanted to have a battle until the morning, so ordered their troops to set up camp. However, as the sun set, a small number of Castilians attacked the Portuguese baggage train. The Portuguese sent men to fight them off. The men from Castile decided to reinforce their mates who were fighting these Portuguese, and accidentally and suddenly, both armies were engaged in a full-scale battle. It was utterly chaotic, and the battle raged for about 2 hours. But the end result, the Portuguese had unexpectedly won a resounding victory. The Battle of Aljubarrota was a battle which had a huge impact upon this region. It signified really the end of attempts by Castile to subjugate Portugal and basically establish Portugal as a truly independent region. On top of this, it inflicted a shattering blow to the power and the prestige of the Castilian military elite. Over half the Castilian army had been killed. Castile would take years, if not decades, to recover from this terrible, terrible loss. And why is this important to London? Well, back in England, the king's uncle, the son of the great King Edward III and younger brother of the Prince of Wales, who was the father of the young king, a man called John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster, was very interested in this. You see, John of Gaunt had tried, unsuccessfully, it must be said, to continue the never-ending war with France that England was raging, to try a new military strategy. The Duke of Lancaster was trying to convince Parliament to cough up a fortune in cash so he could pay for an army and a fleet to invade Iberia and pursue his claim to the throne of Castile, Castile at the time being a French ally. The plan was to gain the throne of this Iberian nation and thereby supply reinforcements to the English holdings in Gascony and force the French to now look to their southern border. It's a great plan, but it would have cost a fortune, and every time the Duke of Lancaster had asked money to do this, the English Parliament had kind of looked at him and said, no. And then news arrived of the Battle of Ajabarato. For the Duke, the timing of this news was perfect, as Parliament was due to meet in a few weeks. He decided to put forward a new version of the plan. He spoke very eloquently and passionately about the opportunity to take on a weakened Castile was right here in front of them. They would never get an opportunity like this again. And Parliament voiced no opposition. The Spanish campaign was on. Now, the complex story of John of Gaunt organizing the building of a huge army and even larger fleet to be assembled over in Plymouth and then sail down to Spain are not the purpose of this podcast. Suffice to say, the Duke of Lancaster did piss off to Spain at the head of a massive army. And he left England for over 2 years. And this is to play a huge role in what hit London. Because his leaving was to have a massive repercussion on English politics over these next 2 years. Why? Well, while for the last few decades the Duke of Lancaster has often been described as this Machiavellian figure whose nephew the King was struggling to come out from under his shadow, in truth, the Duke of Lancaster was actually an astute political operator. Now, he was no saint, and from the point of view of London, he's an encroaching, power-hungry despot. But it becomes clear with hindsight that the Duke of Lancaster was a powerful presence who was keeping a lid on some really deep passions within the country. What deep passions? Let's face it, Richard II at this point was an autocratic teenager with neither the maturity nor the intelligence to mitigate the complex needs of the nation around him. For over a decade, John of Gaunt had steered the royal court through various crises, the last few years of Edward, the opening years of Richard. He'd managed to keep a lid on things, and now he was leaving. And it meant that this young king and the remaining powers of England had nothing to mitigate their personalities in the event of a crisis. And the problem was, no sooner had John of Gaunt left than England suddenly found itself facing a very real crisis. This war with France is ongoing, but suddenly there's a very real possibility that the French are just about to invade. By late September 1386, French preparations for an invasion of England from Flanders were well advanced. It was the French belief that after decades of invasions coming from England into their country, all was needed was one large knockout invasion, and the young English king could be forced to surrender all territorial claims to lands in France, hand back Calais, and the war would be over. A mammoth force of 30,000 soldiers stood waiting just across the channel to commence this attack. And as the summer of 1386 ended, England faced the very real possibility of its greatest risk of invasion in centuries. Certainly, this was the greatest risk to England since the fighting had started all the way back in the 1330s. 1386 should be remembered really as a year of paranoia about when the French were turning up. All through the spring and early summer, there were rumours that the invasion was going to land any day now. The target of where the invasion was going became an endless round of speculation and hysteric fear. In March, it was said that Rye was going to be the target. This theory went out of fashion, and a month later, Sandwich became the favourite, then Porchester. By that May, speculation was now insisting that Thanet and the Isle of Oxney were to be the places where this massive invasion were going to land. Around Rye and Oxney, concern was particularly great. Towards the end of April, the people of that area were actually ordered to retreat within the walls of Dover, Rye or Sandwich to remain there for safety. In France, the residents of English-controlled Calais were convinced they're going to be the target, and they summoned reinforcements and stepped up active patrols and interdictions against French shipping. It did not help the general state of paranoia then when the Calais garrison captured some ships on the channel, and they were carrying pieces of a prefabricated wooden castle, which supposedly was to have been erected to cover the French army's disembarkation on English soil. The royal regime's response to this incredibly hysteric fear was to strengthen the coastal defences of England, repair castles, and special measures were put in place to defend London. On the 2nd of June, the London aldermen were ordered to prepare the wards for defending the city. By the 13th of September, all London households were ordered to make sure they had food supplies to withstand a three-month siege. The nobility and leading knights were ordered to rendezvous with the king at Westminster on the 30th of September. By October, nearly 4,500 men who were in the king's pay were now stationed in positions within a 60-mile radius of the capital. The defence of London was to be in depth, and it's clear why. The city's fall would have destroyed any credibility of the government itself and undermined, if not broken, the system of national defence. Here and now, in the face of French invasion, London had to stand. For those residents of London during this invasion fear, another factor in calculation would have been going through their heads. England was only vulnerable because it could not prevent the invasion fleet from crossing. With a well-supplied fleet, there could have been twice as many French soldiers over in Flanders. They wouldn't have been able to make it. When John of Gaunt had sailed off, he'd taken off a large number of armed men and a large number of ships. The Royal Council knew they simply could not put another fleet to sea. They couldn't afford it. I mean, after paying off that huge Spanish campaign, there was so little cash left that even if they did have the ships, they could not crew them. So even when John of Gaunt, hearing this, sent ships back to help defend England, they ended up sitting idle. The bottom line was, with a fear of invasion this real, the Crown needed cash quickly, so Parliament was summoned. In the meantime, loans were sought out based on the security of, hey, we're going to get some taxes in, so could you give us some money? And during September, all the major money lenders in the land were approached. So we're talking the bishops and the archbishops and all the noble lords and above all the grocers and the merchants of London. But even though needs were desperate, they could only raise £733. Why so little? Well, because of the fear of invasion. One chronicler claimed that so great was the fear of the French arriving that the entire population of the southern counties indulged in a frenetic spending spree. It was felt best to enjoy your wealth while you could before the French turned up and took it all. But despite this, the weeks would pass and the days would grow cold. And September would turn into October. And the fear of invasion began to fade. Slowly, but with growing speed. The people of London and the South realised the French were not going to invade. What our residents of London didn't know was that this massive French army over in Flanders was turning into a total nightmare for its French commanders. They couldn't raise enough money to pay for so many troops. Large numbers of soldiers were now pillaging to support themselves. Then the weather turned and heavy rains and strong winds came in, which prevented sailing for months, and winter was approaching and the conditions promised to get worse. The French realized they needed to cut their losses, and that November, the decision was made to call off any bloody invasion. England had been spared. But when the Parliament of that year met at Westminster, however, it was still October, and even though the panic of invasion was diminishing, it was still underlying. The government turned up needing a huge grant of taxation from the Commons to enable it honour its many commitments towards national defence. The only question was, would Parliament be willing to grant them it? A year before, Parliament had awarded a massive subsidy and a half, some of which was specifically meant to target defence. There were members of the Parliament who thought that should be more than enough. Of course, they all expected the Chancellor, Martin de la Pole, the King's principal servant, to put forward a powerful argument as to the additional monies needed to defend the realm. But Chancellor de la Pole did not do that. He turned up at Parliament and, to everyone's utter surprise, he proposed a different plan. The young king himself would personally lead an invasion. He would invade France. Of course, to do this, His Majesty was having to ask for his subjects for, quote, sufficient aid, unquote. This request for additional taxes to fund this wild plan was greeted at first with Parliament asking just how much money did the king want. The Chancellor hummed and hawed for a bit, and then he asked for a figure of no less than 4/15 and 10ths, which is a technical way to say he asked for a insanely large amount of cash. According to one source, the response was uproar. Never had such a sum been demanded of a parliament. Chancellor de la Pole had completely misjudged the mood of his audience and had provoked a monumental political standoff between the King of England and his parliament. Parliament made the first move immediately. Soon after that inept demand for more taxes, the Lords and the Commons called for de la Pole to be fired, stating openly that they had, quote, business to do with him, which they could not transact so long as he remained in office, unquote. What does that mean? Impeachment. They wanted to put him on trial. The young king automatically refused. Supposedly the teenager reported with a furious sneer, supposedly saying that he would not even dismiss a kitchen scullion from office, let alone his bloody chancellor. He utterly ignored the request of Parliament, demanded they return to other business, and then left Westminster in a sulk. Parliament, however, dug in its heels. They informed King Richard that they would not and could not resume any normal business until he came back to Westminster and fired Michael de la Pole from his post. At this, the King asked for a smaller delegation to come and meet him and discuss their demands with him. The Commons, probably rightfully, thought that any members they sent would be arrested, and so it was decided to send two men to represent the will of the whole Parliament. The King's uncle, the Duke of Gloucester, accompanied by the Bishop of Arundel, were duly sent, and by all accounts they cajoled, and when that failed, sternly talked to the young king, reminding him of his many obligations. The king replied that he bloody well knew his obligations, and Parliament needs to wind its neck in, getting all demanding about them. I am obviously approximating. At some point during Richard's petulant outburst, he said that with all this talk about resistance from the Commons, maybe he should seek out aid and support from his cousin, the King of France. The response from the two delegates was, well, yeah, it wasn't good. They just stared open-mouthed and then they exploded. They pointed out that France was the bloody enemy. The freaking King of France was his biggest enemy. He would not give the young king any advice that would benefit England. They reminded the teenager about all the work his father and grandfather had done to try and win this war, of all the people who had died to try and win this war, and the lands over in France that supposedly belonged to him. The king would be better focused, they felt, on remembering who the real enemy was. And in fact, they would all be happily over in France fighting for him, except the king was broke, his nobles frustrated, and his people were clearly upset. And this wasn't his fault. He's the king. Long live the king. But someone had to take the blame for this pitiful shit show. And the number one candidates, the useless and evil counselors of the king. These guys were clearly advising the king badly. Yeah, that's it. And as such, it was a business parliament to get all up in this and remove these guys. And then after saying this to the king, they reminded him of the old statute, the one that said if the king alienated himself from his people and refused to be governed by the advice of his lords, then these people were entitled to depose him. This was a clear reference to what happened to Edward II. Young Richard crapped himself. The unmistakable reference to the fate of Edward II evidently frightened him. He returned to Westminster immediately and on the 23rd of October fired the offending ministers. On the next day, Bishop Arundel became Chancellor and John Gilbert, the Bishop of Hereford, became the Treasurer. And now De La Pole had been fired, they impeached him. By October 1386, impeachment against De La Pole had been passed, but Parliament was not yet done. By November of that year, the Parliament introduced a much more radical reform. There was formed a, quote, great and continual council, unquote. This council, it was decreed, would basically run England and deal with the plethora of issues facing the nation, especially the need to reform the state's finances. They were, however, only granted this power for one single year. But they had a lot to do in that year. They had to survey the estates and conditions of the royal household. They had to examine all revenues to the state from wherever it came from. They were charged with looking into the cost and expense of defending the kingdom and to examine the realm and investigate all complaints about abuse of the crown's power over the last decade. The council was given the power to enter the household of the king, to compel documents wherever they were, and they were empowered to force officials to do their will. This great and continual council had incredible powers, the like of which had not been seen before, and the only limitation upon it was that it was to exist only for a single year. And yet, even with this move, the Commons and Parliament were not quite done. Towards the end of that extraordinary session of Parliament, the Commons came up with a third and final demand. And this idea seems to have been cribbed from ideas currently taking place in London. The Commons asked that the three principal officers of the state who serve the king alongside the steward of the royal household should now all be chosen and appointed publicly in Parliament. That the great and continual council should continue maybe beyond its 12 months but directly until the next Parliament met. And that the council and the core officers of state were now to remain in Westminster and London so the council could gain access to the records and accounts they needed to conduct their important investigations. The king could only but agree. By the 19th of November, 1386, this great and continual council was in control of virtually every aspect of the government of the realm. By all accounts, its approach to its tasks appeared to have been businesslike and fast-paced. Within only a few weeks of existing, they were focusing on increasing the revenues brought in from the crown, and they were also decreasing the crown's expenditure. They also went after cases of abuse of royal favour from the years previous. But they could only do so much. Their main limitation was that they were ordered to be based in Westminster, which, while granting them access to the records and mechanisms of state in that town, also meant they could not and did not have the authority to follow the young king if he left Westminster, and because of this, they could not get access to his actual royal household. The way they could reduce the king's expenditure was to control the amount of money that was available to him. This had a marginal success. as the young king moved beyond their direct jurisdiction and spent money anyway. But it does appear that the teenager was hit hard that year and spent the months resenting the living hell out of the conditions he was living under. The council was also responsible and tried to pay for the defence of the nation, and that meant building up the country's naval defences. All through the winter of 1386 and into the spring of 1387, a fleet was slowly gathered at Sandwich to be placed under the command of the Earl of Arundel. By March, there was about 60 ships at his disposal, and on the 16th of March, he arrived in Sandwich to take up his command. Within a week, word arrived that an enemy fleet was approaching the English coast. Arundel immediately put to sea, and the next day battle was joined off Cadzand. The enemy fleet was huge, about 250 strong, about four times larger than anything the English could put to sea. But this was medieval sea fighting. It wasn't about cannons, it was all about ships coming together and the soldiers on board physically crossing over and fighting one another. And it appears as if the French did not bring enough soldiers. And that because of the vigorousness of the English fighting during the battle, a large number of German and Dutch ships who had sailed with them decided to, you know, swap sides. The battle was long, but in the end, the Earl won. The Flemish admiral of this French fleet and some 50 of his ships were captured, and another dozen or so sunk or burnt. The result was the worst defeat suffered by the French and the Flemish in the second part of this century. And as a side effect, a huge amount of wine was captured from some of the prizes, and it was sold off, causing the price in wine to London to fall dramatically, as nearly 9,000 wooden tons of the stuff was unloaded and sold off. The Earl of Arundel followed up this success by attacking the Flemish coast. Over a period of 2 to 3 weeks, the countryside around Sluys was systematically pillaged, and loot worth an estimated 200,000 francs was taken. But due to disease amongst his own troops and bad weather, the Earl of Arundel finally returned to England after only a short time abroad. This was great news and a great influx of revenue to the king. Yet despite this, the main preoccupation of the young king was him not being able to be the king right now. The curtailment on his power, the limitations upon him, this was galling to Richard. And without the firm hand of his uncle John of Gaunt to somehow reconcile all the parties, confrontation between the two sides seemed more and more likely as the council's remit came to its end. And the young king seemed to be building for a confrontation, a big one. There are signs he was seeking to build his political and judicial strength before the next parliament. When rallying his supporters around the country, Richard embarked on a policy of consultation with local officials and a bunch of learned judges. At a council in Nottingham that August, he asked a delegation of Londoners what support they could offer in the event of a showdown with this great council. The representatives of the Londoners, recognising the issues going on within their city, gave a non-committal answer, saying that people could not be trusted one way or the other. You see, there was a damn good reason for this. While all this was going on, what was happening in London? Well, as we saw last chapter, we left the story where there was a buttload of political tension and even executions on the street, all caused by the re-election of Nicholas Brambay as mayor. Brambay, however, does seem to be in total control. John de Northampton, his great rival, was jailed for life, along with his confederates Norbury and Moore. But behind this, something deeper was going on. Something that had gotten Nicholas Brambay into politics in the first place. There was an issue with the wool staple. Ah yes, for those who are just joining us, a quick repeat, and for those who've been listening all along, I'm so sorry to bring this back up again, but it needs to be said. The wool staple was a mandatory market for the selling of English wool. Everybody had to sell this product in the staple. There were two versions of it. The version that London liked was that the wool staple was located in a port outside of England. So, for example, Calais, or somewhere over in Holland where it was at the moment. Having a foreign wool staple meant that all the wool merchants in England had to get the wool to London, and the London wool merchants could then, since they had a monopoly on the ships, easily ferry it across and sell it for them. This allowed them to make a shed load of money, which they could then use to buy products from their foreign buyers and then take these goods back to England and sell them for a fortune. A foreign wool staple made London rich, especially the likes of Nicholas Brembe. If you put the wool staple in England, however, this meant that foreigners would come over and they would pay top coin for the English wool, and to pay for it, they would sell a load of expensive products that are wanted in England. So if the wool staple was based here in England, London was in trouble. Got that? Excellent. All right, let's get back to the story. Back in October 1385, when Brembe had beaten John de Northampton, there was a threat to the wool staple in the Parliament, which meant that month, the Chancellor, Michael de la Pole, proposed that it should be relocated to England, allegedly to improve the Crown's revenues. With an English wool staple, the foreigners would pay the Crown a load of money, and that would generate more cash for the Crown. It is worth saying that Pole's patron was John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster, and he wanted the money to come in to fund his, at that point, nobody was saying yes, expedition to Castile. Pole suggested to the Parliament, and this is the one that he went to before he was fired, that the wool staple should return to England. Parliament agreed that the staple should be moved, but they left it to the King's Council to decide how and when to bring that about. At that point, once again, Brembe and the stapler faction in London were under attack by the Duke of Lancaster. Brembe knew he was in no way strong enough to defeat the Chancellor and the Duke of Lancaster while they were in royal favour, but he was also favoured by the royal king. And the teenager's respect for Brembe was shown by his attempt to bring about a reconciliation between the mayor and the Duke of Lancaster at a dinner at which both the king and the queen would be present. The Duke of Lancaster was quite open about making a deal with Brembe. He would be willing to keep the wool staple in Europe if he could get Nicholas Brembe's support for the release of John de Northampton and his confederates More and Norbury. At this, Brembe seems to have promised he would not oppose the return of his political enemies. I mean, if that was the price he had to pay to secure an overseas wool staple, he was clearly willing to pay it. And yet, no sooner was the deal made than it was scuppered. Just before the Duke of Lancaster left to go to Spain, a petition from London was sent to the king from the city opposing the release of Northampton and his associates. John of Gaunt was most not impressed. He sent two letters, one to the mayor and one to the alderman of the city in May 1386, which contained quite a few threats. He wrote to Nicholas Brembe saying he trusted he would not have, quote, any cause or occasion for acting in opposition to the mayor in future, unquote, but that he held Brembe solely responsible for the city's opposition to the pardon of John de Northampton. He then made another threat, saying, quote, in the same manner as the mayor shall prove deserving towards the Duke, so the Duke will behave to the best of his power towards the mayor, unquote. The alderman and the Common Council of London, however, sent a reply to the Duke of Lancaster, claiming they had begged the mayor to send the petition because if Northampton came back to the city, it would be, quote, a great cause of unrest and the occasion of great tribulations and discontent within the city to the subversion of the same, unquote. For years, they said, Northampton and his followers had been regarded as nothing more than, quote, rioters, brawlers, disturbers of the peace, initiators and maintainers of common quarrels and riots in the city. being men engaged to the utmost of their power in oppressing the people and subverting the city, unquote. Now, I'm sure Nicholas Brembe had nothing to do with that letter. There now follows some serious disagreement, actually, between some historians, as if the Common Council was saying this because of Brembe and his former allies, the fishmongers, who were furious at Northampton. And this is all just a pantomime designed to remove Nicholas Brembe from the equation. Or those who believe that the hatred of Northampton across the city was actually legitimate. It comes down to if we should see Nicholas Brembe as an evil manipulator or not. Me, you won't be surprised by my descriptions that I did think he was, but I will give a concession. London was, as we have seen, a city of highly passionate politics. Affiliation today could mean betrayal tomorrow. There was no loyalty anymore. Factions worked in self-interest and upon perceptions of power. It was most likely that with Nicholas Brembe as mayor, seemingly having the ear of the king, and with the Duke of Lancaster ready to leave to go to Spain for a few years, the members of the Court of the Aldermen and the Common Council could have decided that, you know what, it'd be a bad move if John Northampton returned right now, hence the petition. But Brembe's control of London was strong enough to secure the election of two grocers, John Hadley and Adam Carlyle, in company with a mercer and a fishmonger, to represent the city in the Parliament in the autumn of 1386. And these elections took place under the huge threat of invasion by the French. Brembe issued proclamations for the defence of the city during that invasion scare. Quote, whereas Nicholas Brembe, the mayor, and the alderman had heard from William Beauchamp, captain of Calais, and others, that a great number of ships of France and Flanders had been prepared for a descent on England, the said mayor and alderman caused good men of each ward to meet in the council chamber of Guildhall on the 18th of July to take steps for the safeguarding of the realm, unquote. Brembe was always a man of action, and after said deliberations, it went on to be proclaimed, quote, that those able and willing to go to the sea coast in defence of the realm and the city should come to the Guildhall to the mayor and chamberlain and receive pay, 12 pence a day for men-at-arms properly arrayed and 6 pence for archers, that no freeman leave the city without special permission, and that those freemen then absent should return within 8 days, that no armourer, boyer or fletcher enhance the price of his wares in consequence of this proclamation, that those men-at-arms and archers who were able but not willing to go should be arrested as traitors to the king and the city, that no foreigner of any nation whatsoever carry knife, baselard, sword or any arms, and that no one wander about the city after 9 o'clock, unquote. So, yeah, he took action. London took this invasion fear very, very seriously, and as we said, the Crown had ordered them to store up food for months, just in case a siege happened. Brembe ordered that money should be borrowed for the defence of the city fund, which existed to provide for the needy. Measures were taken to provision the city and fix the price of coal, which was increasingly now becoming to be depended upon for fuel. But the story we told about the parliamentary struggles against the Crown are now thrown into sharp relief. From the point of view of London, well, the Duke of Lancaster had left the country dangerously exposed to French attacks, which in turn had brought great unpopularity on the circle of the king's advisers and ministers. The mayor and the city now faced a bevy of confusing positions to take. Brembe was personally loyal to the king, but he was opposed to De la Pole, as De la Pole has suggested an end to the overseas staple. But the enmity between Brembe and the Duke of Gloucester, who was trying to get De la Pole fired, was deep and long-lasting. And Gloucester was supported by the Earls of Arundel and Warwick, but Arundel was also the kind of aggressive naval leader London had wanted to protect shipping to the staple for ages, and they liked him. There were no simple choices to make, no simple paths to follow. It was a deadly miasma of risk, consideration and political choice. added to the older nobles who were going after Delapole, there'd now arisen a new faction made up of a new court party which had grown up around the 19-year-old king. It was composed partly of old servants of the Black Prince, such as Sir Simon Burley and the Knights of the Chamber, but was increasingly dominated by ambitious favourites of the king. Young nobles led by Robert de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, including Thomas Mowbray, the Earl of Nottingham. And they had wanted to discredit the Earl of Lancaster before he left. And for these guys, turning on Delapole was an extension of their ambitions against the now out-of-country Duke. And they added an additional confusing choice of who to support for Brembe in London. But Brembe's choices were ultimately dictated by the needs of the city. Delapole had made himself an enemy by the proposal of the Home Staples. The old guard nobles wanted war in France, and London felt that even though, you know, defending Calais was important, that the foreign staple in Middleborough had served them just as well, so yeah, they didn't need a war too much. The king's young favourites had shown signs of being dangerously headstrong in some of their behaviour, which we covered last chapter. And Richard himself, the king, had exhibited emotional instability. But he was still young, and Brembe had seen at first hand how this young man had faced down terrors during the peasants' revolt. And he had every reason to sympathise with him, wanted to have men around him who would bolster up his confidence in himself. Brembe seemed to advise the city that their real hope was that if the insecure king could ignore the flatterers of his royal favourites, he could perhaps focus on the calming influence of the young queen and the tried and steady counsels of Simon Burley and of Burley's nephew, Sir Baldwin of the Royal Wardrobe. It was towards the likes of Simon Burley that Brembe seemed to make London align with. Burley understood the financial value of an alliance with the Stapler faction, and Brembe had shown he had the city under his firm control. If the king were to have any chance of ruling in his own right, independently of all these bloody factions, he needed the financial support which the Staplers could provide, and that support would be his at the price of commitment to an overseas staple. In all likelihood, it was the influence of Burley which prevented the King's Council from implementing the move of the staple to England. In return, Brembe made a new loan to the Crown and was accepted within the King's inner circle of advisers because of it. So when the Parliament assembled on the 1st of October 1386 at Westminster, and the Duke of Gloucester and the Old Guards aligned with the Commons to replace the Chancellor, this was what Brembe was walking into. And what made it more complicated was he was just about to try for his third election for mayor. And at this point, Nicholas Brembe made a realistic calculation. The mayoral election would take place on the 13th of October. And England was right in the middle of that standoff between Parliament and the Crown. Above all, the Commons and Parliament appeared to be winning that standoff. Brembe was already too closely linked to the royal party to be encouraged by the Staplers to seek a third year as mayor. Nicholas Exton, on the other hand, had a reputation of being a bold and outspoken leader. He and the fishmongers could commend themselves to the Earl of Gloucester simply by the fact that he'd attacked Delapole as far back as the 1384 Parliament. Yes, Nicholas Exton, the fishmonger we first mentioned many episodes ago, beating up people in Southwark, who'd been an MP, who'd suffered under John de Northampton. He was now the leading candidate and the chosen candidate to become the successor to Brembe, to become mayor. Now, despite having thrown the fishmongers under the bus in the wake of John de Northampton's actions, a quick reconciliation between the grocers and the fishmongers was now in order, and Brembe seems to have used all his influence to secure Nicholas Exton's election, because even if it meant a compromise with the Earl of Gloucester, at all costs, the overseas staple had to be secured. And so Exton became mayor. By the 24th of October, the king had been forced to admit defeat in his struggles with Parliament, and Parliament's nominees took over the government, and the council now began their work. The city lent the new administration £4,000, and Middleborough was recognised as the official staple. The fishmonger William Brampton was chosen at its governor, a manifestation of the power of the fishmonger Nicholas Exton as mayor. The alliance with the ruling council gave the staplers as well as the mercers everything they wanted. The government organised convoys from London to Middleborough. The Earl of Arundel, as we said, aggressively defended the sea trade. This was a kind of more proactive naval policy the merchants, and the wool merchants in particular, of London had wanted for years. And the command which it gave them of the English Channel confirmed them in their support of the new regime. Brembe, by contrast, remained the one prominent Londoner who did not give up on his loyalty to the king. Instead, he kept his links with the royal household and, in fact, improved them. From the point of view of Brembe and Exton working together, the mayor was now being seen as being pro this council and pro regime, while Brembe, the man who'd chosen the mayor, was all up being friends with the young king. They were playing this really smart. But it is right now that Nicholas Exton felt strong enough in his alliance with the council running England to take revenge for his and his profession's humiliation at the hands of John de Northampton. On Saturday, the 16th of March, 1387, a genuinely remarkable event occurred in the history of the city. Remarkable even by the standards of the time. Nicholas Exton summoned a special meeting of the city's Common Council, reinforced by other more reputable and substantial men, including Nicholas Brembe. So many arrived at this meeting, pre-warned as to what it would be covering perhaps, or brought in by the fishmongers and grocers to make up the numbers, that they could not be accommodated in the upper chamber where the Common Council normally met, and so they had to move to the Guildhall below. Here the mayor, the sheriffs and the aldermen, together with this very enlarged Common Council, numbering over 150 citizens, came together to discuss a certain book called the Jubilee Book. It was blamed in this meeting for the rise in great controversies, dissensions and disputes amongst the good citizens of London. And why? Well, it was alleged to contain, quote, certain new oaths of the officers of the said city and certain new ordinances repugnant to the old and approved customs of the same, unquote. And now the mayor and the aldermen and the great and the good, along with this large body, came to a firm judgment. Quote, it was agreed and adjudged that the said choir or book should be burnt on the same day in the place without the Guildhall, unquote. And so they took the Jubilee into the yard outside of the Guildhall and they set it on fire. It must be understood, in future years, the burning of books was to become a comparatively commonplace thing with the advent of popular heresy. But right now, book burning was very unusual in England. Yes, occasionally around this time, witches and wives who murdered their husbands were burnt alive. And as we've seen, defective or putrid goods put on sale for the public were sometimes burnt under the noses of those who were placed in the pillory for having attempted to pass them off onto the public. But not books. Burning books was new. What was it about the Jubilee Book that it should have aroused such passions? What was it that drove men to burn this book before the Guildhall? And that's exactly what we need to look at. Why was it so important that Exton and Brembe decided they need to burn it? And to do that, I'm going to be dedicating a special episode straight to this and announcing that, yes, it's one of those weird weeks where I'm doing two episodes in one week. Because next chapter, it's time to look at this book, The Jubilee. Where did it come from? Why was it so important? And what made it special? So, within 48 hours after this episode comes out, they'll be dropping the next chapter, chapter 138, where I'll be looking at the Jubilee. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and you could follow it. Oof, this saga, it'll be the death of me. But we're ploughing on through. So I'll be speaking to you, I hope, in a couple of days. This is Saul saying thanks. Bye.